Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Now mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday the 27th of November. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight, we hear about the latest album release from former Lower Hutt-based musician Darren Watson, ahead of its launch at Alice Towns of the Shed, and we'll sample some of the new tracks and music from Darren Watson Sings John Hiatt. We finish our chat with the author of Tackling the Hens, a poetry book from former Eastbourne writer Mary McCallum. We hear more poems about Mary's two print houses and more about the people who helped with the collection. And there's music from Upper Hutt's Yahoo Choir Boy to go out with, Someone Stole My Jandals. As this is our last show for spring 2025, let's start things off with a seasonal poem from Lower Hutt's Vivian Ball.
I've written some poems on the seasons. This winter and spring has been very up and down, often cold and windy and sometimes stormy. In my journal, I've been noting my observations, especially in the morning. These notes have turned into poems and two small prayers. I've titled the poems Glimpses of the Season. My first poem is A Glimpse of Spring. A glimpse of spring. Thank you for spring, for the birth of children and grandchildren, for the colour of flowers in bloom, and flowers nearly in bloom, bursting into the world. For the still day with no movement in the clouds, just calm, with white puffs on the blue sky. This day is filled with new life. So many possibilities, so many things still to be birthed, new ways of life, new imaginings. I hear bird sounds in the distance, a tui calls. I see flowers, pink and purple, fern fronds, green and silver, reaching out. I imagine wondrous life bursting forth, creativity renewing tired minds. Opportunities offered to searching souls, seeds being watered with careful hands, sun shining on delicate tiny plants, growing into fields of red and yellow, white and blue, beautiful life, transcendent love shining on this day. Ah, spring, you give freely, abounding with growth. Strengthening the weary to soar mountains, helping all who will take a moment of quiet to see the wonderment and magnificence of creation.
And that was Vivian Ball reading her poem, A Glimpse of Spring. Let's keep in the poetry zone and finish off our chat with former Eastbourne-based writer and publisher Mary McCallum, talking about her new poetry collection.
My name's Mary McCallum and I've written a book called Tackling the Hens.
Whereabouts in the Wairarapa are you then?
We're just south of Martinborough, about... 7.67 k's from the square. It's called Dry Rock Olives. We've got 2,000 olive trees, and my husband tends them beautifully, makes gorgeous olive oil with them. And I'm very lucky. I pickle some olives sometimes, but I don't have a lot to do with the making of the olive oil. But it's a very peaceful place. And it's where I find, that's where I have the most contact with nature now. You're just sitting in it and looking at it and tackling the hens, that sort of thing, yeah.
Could we get a bit of a read of summer then, please?
Oh, yeah. That's That was actually written quite a while ago, you can tell, because you've got quite young girls in this one, haven't I? And the dog's still around. Yeah, it's funny how long it's been around this one. Summer. Toenails freshly pink, washing on the line held by the last of the pegs. Apricots the colour that can only be called apricot, perfect for picking but rotten by noon. Bees sip the lavender. The dog has, after a small performance, swallowed her pill. The girls are up at last cracking eggs for pancakes. Blitz of the coffee grinder, chuckle of fledglings on the roof wanting breakfast, one being taught how to fly. An asterisk of a cloud dissolving in the time it takes to walk to the compost bin. Summer here, a held breath. Now a thousand trees exhale. Now the deep greening that susurrates, resuscitates. This pixelated sunlight, leaves startled into silver. Yeah. Mm. A lot of sounds in there that I really like. And there's the compost burning. How gorgeous. Yeah.
Now, it's published by your company, Cuba Press, but I see you're still a director of Macaro Press.
Yep.
So what's Macaro Press's operating state?
So that kicked publishing off for me back in 2013, and we did the Eastbourne Anthology. So we began then, and we kept going, doing many different books, you know, fiction, poetry, non-fiction, etc., till 2018. And then I started a new press up with another person who became my co-director, Sarah Bolland. We wanted a slightly different emphasis in what we were doing and a different consistent way of funding publishing, because it's very hard to publish books. There's not a lot of money out there. So we became a sort of solid hybrid publisher, if you like, where we ask authors to put money into the publishing where appropriate. So that's how that worked. That's the Cuba Press. But I wanted to keep Makaro Press going. It was close to my heart. It was named after Makaro Island, which I looked at every day. We'd done some beautiful books with Makaro, and I just thought, no, we'll keep going. So basically what it does now, and it may change, but I don't think so. I think is every year one literary novel, because that's, I guess, I mean, I love poetry so much, but the literary novel is very hard to publish in this country and to convince people of, you know, but I'm still not sure why you'd read a literary novel. I don't know why, but I really wanted to keep doing that. I think I'm a good literary editor and publisher of those books. So that's the emphasis of Makaro. So that's where Becky Manawatu came in with Owe, which was a the biggest book for us. We've sold well over 30,000 of that title. It's been translated all over the world. It's still selling well, and her sequel, Katarina. But we've published a number of other wonderful novels through Makaro. It's very special. We've got Empathy out this year by Brian Wolpert. Yeah, so we'll keep going with that. That really matters to me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you got any Hutt Valley authors you're currently working with in any of these titles?
That's currently working with, I'm trying to think. Well, I'm in a writing group with Kristen Phillips, and she's working on something that she's going to give to me. So, we will do that through the Cuba Press imprint. But not too long ago, we published Maggie Rennie Smith's Formica, which was fantastic. That was quite autobiographical too, poetry.
True. Yeah.
And hopefully she's doing something else. I would love to do more with Maggie. Her work's, I think, pretty wonderful.
So can you give us sort of a feel of some of the authors over the years that you've actually been working with them from the Eastbourne type area?
Yeah, from Eastbourne and the Hutt, there's quite a number. And I only found that looking through our shelves before I came down. So the Eastbourne Anthology was the first, and there were, I think, 99, 100 different writers there of all ages, which I'm very proud of. And I did that with Maggie Rainey Smith and Anne Manchester. They were my co-editors. And then we published it. We published Jill Harris, children's author. I don't know if you remember her books, but The Red Suitcase was marvellous. Maggie Rainey Smith, as I say, her novel Daughters of Messini and poetry as well. Pete Carter, who died recently, his poetry, that was amazing. He was one of our first. And then Alan Bagnall, children's writer, with his lovely Sam and Lucy fables. Anne Manchester, you've interviewed.
We have indeed, yeah.
Her Andrew stories, which were classic, included her son, lovely son who died. And there's Robin Cooper, children's writer. And Gary did amazing, the lockdown diary of Uncle Squirrel and Pooh Hoy Pete that started life on the Facebook.
Oh, and I remember those.
Do you remember that?
The Facebook page? It was quite iconic, wasn't it?
People loved it. Yeah. Every
waiting for it
day, I think she did a post. And they loved them so much. She put photos of these two characters that she had doing various things during lockdown. And then we put them together into a book that was very popular, sold out very quickly. David McDougall was a local. He had some lovely stories. Gail McJorrow, her book about alternative funerals, and this incredible launch at Rona Gallery, who are big supporters of ours, with a coffin that we put our drinks on. Classic. Classic Gail. Mark Blackham is Mavella. So that's the Eastbourne lot, apart from, as I say, all those many, many names in the Eastbourne anthology. And then we had, Dorothy Buchanan, The Birds Began to Sing, very important person in the Eastbourne musical history. And Ian Harris with New World, New God, and another book, Hand in Hand, sort of philosophical book about religion. And then we've had, her hut people. You've mentioned Kristen Phillips, but there was Keith Westwater, a poet, David Cohen, journalist, Tim Jones, and a former diplomat called Nick Bridge. So there were those. There must be more I've maybe missed, but all of them very important to us, and it was always a joy to work with those
prolific
local people.
Prolific place of ideas.
Yeah, it is. A lot of creative people, I think so. We also worked with the Hetet Press to produce Māori Weaving. Was an incredible book they wanted to bring back, and so we did that. I was also very proud of that and that connection. And we published a book called O Kiwi Brown, which is about, was set in Eastbourne a while back. That's the author wasn't from Eastbourne, but
the story was, yeah, we covered that.
She had a fabulous
on the show too.
Yeah.
It's a good read.
It is really her knowledge of the area, what she'd gleaned, worked very well to make a terrific story. So yeah, those were our people. Yeah.
Now, the dedication is to your late mother, Norma. Was she the start of your love of poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who knows? It could be genetic, just as in, just literally that you're born with this something in your genes that said poetry's for you. But I think it was probably a combination. I've seen it in my family come through various threads. So there's others who've written poetry, and Mum certainly did write. But she used to leave poetry lying around the house. She's that mother. A whole stack of them in the loo to read. Piled up on bookshelves and on tables. She read them herself. It was something I just wanted to have a part of, really. It felt natural to me, reading it out loud, learning poems off by heart. I learned these long epic poems like The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes by heart, And then I went on at school, to study it and write it, and then on into university to do the same, and then want to publish my own. Yeah, so Mum was huge in that.
Now, looking at the acknowledgements, I see you acknowledge Bill Manhire. What was Bill Manhire's sort of role in all this?
So when I was at university the first time round, I would have been about 19, I think. I applied for his early creative writing course. So he'd just started out this, I think it was only a half year course. And it was, what did he call it? Oh, it had a funny name. Original Composition, which sounds strange. But there weren't a lot of creative writing courses then. And I'm trying to think how many there were, probably a dozen of us in the class. Some had published already and others hadn't. And Kirsty Gunn was there with me. We were the two youngest. We hadn't published and we were super keen to do so. And Bill was the man, much younger Bill. And that was in 1980. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was just opening onto New Zealand writing, New Zealand writers, and where you can go with poetry, which is actually anywhere. And it was established it for me as something I should do, and that I could feel confident doing. I didn't always do it in the ensuing years. I got caught up sort of being a journalist, earning money as a writer in other ways. But it was always there in the background. And I'm always so grateful to Bill. And he still calls me, even when I wasn't even producing many poems or publishing much, he would still call me a poet, which is very important to hear when you start thinking, am I even? And then he goes, yep, you're a poet, so that feels like a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He actually took us as a lecturer at the Victoria University as well, and he was very good. He was very enthusiastic, which was in the mid-80s, you know, so he was relatively
young
then
as well. That's right.
But I do remember him as a standout lecturer.
Yeah, and actually, I have to say, then years later, I went back and did the master's that they've got in creative writing, and Bill was one of the two tutors then. Damien Wilkins was the other. So I had a bit to do with Bill then, obviously, but Damien was my tutor because then I chose to write my novel.
He's from the Hutt Valley as well, isn't he?
He is indeed. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
He is. Your artist contributions, how do they fit into the book? Annie Heywood, Fifi Colston, Helen Reynolds, and Claire Bennion, how do they fit in?
Oh, so they've all got a poem written about one of their artworks. And I think that's how I thought that I should give them some credit, because you're using their art in effect in another form. And so I thought I'll do that. So, yes, so Annie Heywood, the book, The Fact of the Giant Cat, which is this book, I actually own it. It's a little painting of a house, actually, in Masterton, with a cat walking in front of it. Claire Bainon is a poet I've published and an artist, and I've written a poem about her. Fifi Colston, I wrote about one of her works that she did that I really liked. And the other artist, Helen Reynolds, is interesting because she bought the first house we lived in Eastbourne, which was in Hodhery Terrace. And there was an interesting connection there. She was an artist, I'd been a poet, writer, living there. And we came to know each other through our daughters, really, who were friends. And then she encouraged me to put together a chapbook, which is a sort of almost an unbound, limited collection of poems. Back before I'd done these two collections, I hadn't brought my poems together. I'd been doing all these other things I was describing. And she said, would you be part of an exhibition I'm doing and do some writing around it? So that kind of kicked me back into poetry again. So I'm really grateful. Mm-hmm. So there are two poems in there with her in them, and one is about the fact that she's in my house making her art, which I found kind of lovely. I wasn't jealous or anything. And the other one is this one where I'm crossing the Remutaka Hill going home, and I say something about clouds because some of her lovely artwork had a lot of clouds in it. Yeah.
Reaction to the book?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some lovely reactions from people. I have to say, I really like when I get, you know, locals like the Eastbourne friends and others I knew there, when I see their reactions, that really does something for me. They see themselves in the poems. Like the one, It's Got a Leaf, when I put that up on Facebook, and all these people who knew the Lye family and knew the Eastbourne Fruit Supply were like, yes, you know. It matters that I've sort of captured a moment in time like that, and people can recognise that. And it kind of acknowledges those people, lifts them up a little bit, and it gives me a lot of pleasure, actually, when that happens. Yeah, it's a lovely thing. I've had some great reviews, people like Irene Beautré, who noted that my novel started with hens, and I seem to have hens here as well. And she liked the domestic life of it, and a kind of the sort of way which I'd hoped people would see, that there's, even though there's some sad stuff in there, that ultimately it's about finding joy and wonder. I guess that would be my main thrust. So I love it when people find that.
Mm. Now, you were called on the Radio New Zealand interview a national treasure.
You don't have to repeat that.
What was your reaction when you heard that?
What was going on? That seems a little bit crazy. I don't think that's true. I don't think so. I think there are
you can't get much better than
that.
There
are more national treasures. No. I think it's just that people see what you're doing when you're publishing and writing. They see the stuff you do. And I guess when you're also rounding up other people to make the best of themselves and getting their books into the world, it's a kind of a bit like a mother hen, shall we say, making that happen and opening up the world for other people. So they like that, and they think you're pretty cool doing it. And I certainly feel I'm the one who's privileged. Mm.
What other writing projects have you got on the go for yourself?
So I'm always writing poetry, and I've actually, you know, and sharing them with and getting feedback from my writing group. That's been marvellous, and that's kept me at it more consistently. So every week I'm trying to write something. For a while I tried to do one every day, but that was crazy. I couldn't get to work on time. I'm trying to, rather than the domestic stuff, and the personal, I thought I'd try a little something different, where I'm trying to sort of have more of a political feel to the poetry, looking at what's happening in the Middle East and in America now, and all these the horrors out there, frankly, and then the lives we live here and our own, the stuff we're going through in a smaller way, and how these things kind of bounce off each other. I'm not sure if it's working, but I'm keeping going with it, and I want to try it because I don't, I'd like to try something a bit different. So I'm gathering these, and actually I'm quite enjoying sharing them. There's an open mic for spoken word up at the Underworld Tavern in Mount Victoria that Simon Sweetman runs. So I've been, you know, trying these poems out there, and that's kind of good to get feedback for them. So who knows, you might see them in a book one day. I'm still writing this novel, which is set in Eastbourne. That always felt a bit tricky, to be honest, a bit different from writing poems set there. I'll keep going with it. I'll see one day, who knows. Or it may just be a project that just sits to one side. Yeah.
The best place for Hut Zone Radio listeners to follow your work, to purchase this book, where would that be?
So the book can be bought in, should be available in all good booksellers, but not all of them will have them in, so if you want it, just ask and they can order it. It's easily gettable. There are copies at Unity. They're very loyal to my presses and to me, so I'm thrilled about that. They can follow Facebook. I've got Mary McCallum author page. And Instagram, I'm on there. Yeah, I guess that's probably it. Yeah.
I thought we could end with the poem Morning, please.
Ah. Yeah, an interesting reader, John. Very interesting. Another one I've not read at all anywhere. Right. So thank you. Yeah, this is very much an Eastbourne poem. And it's that whole thing of that being by the sea, waking up in the morning and the light coming in as it only can in that part of the world. Morning. Don't deceive me, precious morning. No, my sweet, do not. Your skin's so fresh and born in air. Deceptions leave their marks on there, like the tick of cloud on the blue of sky above the startled hills. I need you to be true, my love, when I breach sleep and walk barefoot, yawning to the morning room, day tugging on my sleeve, asking for a piece of this or that. I need your held breath, your pale stare, your cool, complacent, unmarked cheek, and the way you sit, transparently waiting for me.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was local writer and publisher Mary McCallum sharing some of the poems from her latest book, Tackling the Hens, published by the Cuba Press and available from all good bookstores. My next guest has just released a new album, and as he hails from the Hut, went to Hutt Valley High School, and given it's been over 4 years since we last talked, I thought I'd catch up for a chat and hear some of his new music.
Ever been under, all the way under, like I have, oh, like I have.
Darren Watson sings John Hiatt, and it's out now in all good record stores.
To start with a broad question, what was the story in you picking John Hiatt's music for your latest album?
Well, I've been talking about this with friends for, like, decades, man, because I'm just such a huge Hiatt fan, and I found myself kind of covering his songs live quite often. I just learn them and play them, and it's, I don't know, I just came to me a couple of years back to think, why don't I try and do a whole record of, like, a mark of respect kind of thing, really.
How did you get introduced to his music in the first place?
Well, a musician friend of mine put a cassette on a tour bus in 1988 and played Bring the Family. And I just was totally mesmerized from note one, really. Then I went back and checked out some of his earlier stuff. And obviously that was kind of mid-career for John. He started in 1974. And he's written for a bunch of other people as well as put out his own music. So it was a real awakening for me. I'd heard of Roy Cooter before, and I'm quite a big Roy Cooter fan, but that's how I kind of got so you can check this Waikuta plays on this record, this guy John Hyatt. And wow. Not only that, but Nick Lowe on bass and Jim Keltner on drums. It's just an amazing record. And it blew me away and still does, really, as does a lot of his other stuff.
But he's got a huge collection of work and a lot of albums. How did you go through then pick your 9 tracks for your version of it?
Yeah, well, it took about 18 months of going through. First of all, I wanted to find stuff that was a little on the more obscure side, generally, because I just don't see the point in covering stuff that's been covered to death, although I did do one. And that was about 40 tunes that I came up with in the end. And then it was a matter of trying to find a way to play them into my own style and then accepting the ones that kind of weren't working for what I wanted to do and kind of zoning in on the 20 or so that I thought I'd like to record. And then we ended up recording about 15 and about 9 of them made the cut. So that's the record. That's about 40 minutes long, which I reckon is long enough for a record. But yeah, there's a lot of powering down. It's like there's a lot of stuff left on the cutting room floor, so to speak.
Now, you say cover, but from the ones I've listened to, it's a very different rearrangements that you've done and put your own spin on it, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, I don't think there is a point of doing a cover unless you're going to do something else with it. Because otherwise you're just kind of doing what's already been done and maybe not as well. So all my favourite, you know, if you say cover or renditions or I don't know how else to describe it, but all my favourite things, other people's versions of songs are bring something of their own to the party. Like Devo turned Working in the Coal Mine into something completely different. They didn't just try and sound like Tommy Dorsey. And, you know, and again, if we're going to do Talking Heads, they made Al Green's Take Me to the River their own as well. I think that's kind of important. Otherwise, you know, just go back and listen to the original, really.
So how did you then approach making the album? How did you sort of go through doing the rearrangements and the like? What was the process there?
Well, I mean, initially I just sat down with my phone and recorded myself singing and playing, you know, over and over again in various different ways. It was a long process, and then pondering on what I wanted to kind of add, if anything, you know, whether just going to be acoustic and guitar and vocals or what else was I going to add. And then gradually the picture kind of built up, like I say, of these roughly 15 songs that I thought would work in various forms. And then it was a matter of kind of recording as many of the people as I could get in the room at the same time just to get that kind of live vibe. And then overdub some stuff to make it, you know, but a sprinkle of, like, the backing vocals are all just me. Yeah, so it's live-ish, this one. But the actual vibe of the thing is live because, you know, I'm sitting and playing and singing at the same time. There's no recording separate instruments, you know, on their own kind of thing and layering it up. A little bit of that happened afterwards, but mostly it's very live. So I kind of reproduce a lot of it quite well, just the three of us and the little trio I've got running, so... Yeah, it's cool. I really enjoyed it. Mixing it's not so much fun. I'm not a big fan of doing all that technical stuff, but if I don't, who's going to do it? So, so there you go. So I get all that as well, the engineering and the mixing and stuff. So,
who was your other musicians that you just mentioned there involved in the trio? Yeah.
The core is probably me and Steve Moody. Steve Moody's my kind of long-time bass compadre. I'm playing Steve for over kind of almost 15 years now, I guess. Double bass player, fantastic musician. Really, really gets this roots music thing, like, beautifully. And a guy called Chris Armour, who came to me for one guitar lesson when he was about 20, I think, and I just pointed him in the right direction, and off he went, and he's an absolute monster guitar player. So that's the core of the band. Also got Matt Hay played harmonica on a track. Delia Shanley played a bunch of percussion. She was on my last couple of records as well, and some drums on one track. And I kind of fiddled in the rest with some melodica and some organ and some kind of, I think me and Delia probably did all the hand claps, and then I did the backing vocals. So it's a very, very DIY and small-scale thing, but I think it's got a vibe as a whole. It works as an album, so I'm really pleased with it.
Got the ring my sister gave me, said it was my mom's. The day she died of cancer, I stole her morphine and gone. I lived like a lion, baby, for a couple more years. I used to roll through here like a freight train, but I
slipped my key.
Where did you record?
Oh, yeah, so it's all recorded basically in my home, my rental, on the cusp. Real estate agents would say it's in Kandala, but it's actually in Nile. And it's just basically a bedroom where I teach out of, is my control room. So I've got my setup there, and then I run a bunch of leads into the lounge and stuff, and we all record in the lounge, which means means waiting for planes, you know, looking at the flight radar and seeing when the planes are coming over. Like I said, it's very DIY. But I think we've got it. And so the last album was recorded that way too, Getting Sober for the End of the World. So it's a way of working, and it's comfortable, you know. It's not, you're not kind of watching the clock, so you don't have to accept the stuff that isn't quite there. So yeah, really thrilled with it.
What sort of permissions and copyrights do you have to do this album? What's special in this case?
Oh boy. Yeah, it's pretty spendy. So you've got to get clearance, obviously, to make a CD, which means going through MCOS and paying it out. I think it's about $600-$700 to make 500 CDs. So that has to be paid up front, and about the same again to be allowed to sell downloads, and that's only for 100 downloads. So I'm going to run out of that soon enough and then have to pay that again. I mean, I don't mind. It's great. John should be paid. You know, songwriters should be paid for their work. It's, you know, on the streaming services and stuff, they all take care of that and take it as a cut out of the incredible amounts of streaming money that we get. So, yeah, it's a bit of upfront cost than if you're recording all originals, but I kind of knew that going in. And the whole thing was kind of funded by my fan base, who are amazing. It's just never ceases to amaze me, the people that support me through the years on Pledge Me. So got a bunch of money up front that kind of more or less paid for everything. And then we just, as we went through the production process, we whittled that money away. You know, we're not going to make a great deal of money on this thing, but it's not what it's about. You know, if I wanted to make money, I would have gone to law school like I was supposed to. It's just a passion. And this record is, I'm really, really pleased I've done it.
What's been the reaction then? Because it's been out just for a few weeks now. It looks pretty good. Yeah. From your point of view, what are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm pretty thrilled with the response. Like, the reviews have all been really nice. A couple of really perceptive ones, a couple of them really seem to get what's going on, which is really nice, because obviously it's nice when the music can speak for itself and the kind of way it was recorded speaks for itself. And it charted really in the first week. It debuted at like number 3 on the New Zealand Artist Chart, which is really nice, and 31 on the main chart. But even just making a chart at all these days for this kind of music, which is very niche, is remarkable. More than anything, I'm just thrilled that people like it, and you know, people contacting me on social media saying how much they're enjoying it. I did have one person at a gig tell me that thought I was committing sacrilege and I'd ruined his favourite music. But there's always one.
I learned a lot. I really enjoyed listening to it, and I listened to John Hyatt's version, but I must admit, the ones I was listening to, I preferred your take on it to some of his stuff. So that was really good.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, I still like John's versions. The thing is, I can always listen through how things are done to hear the kernel of the song underneath it. And I wanted to find ones that weren't as popular and weren't maybe as well understood and try and put them in a context that might have made them a little more palatable. So hopefully I've succeeded in doing that, which is, yeah, pretty thrilling.
Take the next train southward bound, carry you out of Lincoln Town. I'm going down Lincoln Town. Turn your pretty little head around. Take the next train southward bound.
Particular, the more solid kind of blues-based ones that really rock along live. I'm really looking forward to playing them with the lads next week.
This is the Wellington launch of it, is it?
Yeah, so we're doing two shows, 28th Friday at the Shed, Lower Hutt, and then Friday the week after on the 5th of December at the Shed again. And then we're doing the 6th in Palmerston North at the Globe Theatre. Then I'm heading down to Nelson on the 13th, and then I'm going on holiday and looking at doing some more shows in 2026. Yeah, I think this little trio is something I'll keep kind of ticking over and see what happens next.
Has John Hyatt himself heard it or responded at all in this process?
No, I don't think so. And I realistically don't think he probably ever will. I don't know how he would. I did, offer downloads to his management company and record company, but I just never heard anything back. So I expect that'll just go in the file in bin Z. And because, just some small guy from the bottom of the world, we don't even get included on the maps half the time. So so who knows, mate? If he did it, I'd be interested to see what he thought. I'm a huge fan, obviously. I've seen him here in about 92, and I was just blown away. He's an amazing performer, had an amazing life, and just one of the most gifted songwriters. Now, I put him right up there with Dylan and Lennon and McCartney, and he really is up there. And he'd be up there with Hank Williams too. He's pretty special. He's got a really idiosyncratic style, but he manages to put it in so many different contexts, which is probably why he's not as well known as some other musicians, because he is so flexible as a songwriter. So massive amounts of admiration for his stuff. There's a couple of albums that I play regularly to this day, and there aren't many stay in my play the whole album playlist, so pretty cool.
I play some poker on a Friday night, but I'm always holding my cards too tight. I gotta tell, it's my twitchy eye. They take my money and it makes me cry. Oh, nothing I love. Oh, nothing I love. Nothing I love is good for me but you.
How are you going to do the Wellington launch? I know they're both sold out, but how are you planning to run those concerts?
Oh, I mean, it'll be very informal. They're intimate. I mean, there's only about 40 people at each show, so it's going to be very much lots of chat, really low-volume acoustic. Well, Chris plays electric guitar, but it's not going to be screaming rock and roll. It's going to be listening. At other shows, people have been singing along, singing, answering phrases, and clapping. It's been a real buzz. So just a real kind of front porch kind of vibe, really. And obviously there'll be CDs and stuff. People still buy CDs. So there'll be CDs at the shows.
Hmm. Now, on a slightly different topic, but what I've seen that you've commented recently on was on AI in the music world. And because you've been recently approached from some AI suppliers. What was involved in the approach that happened to you recently?
Well, I do session work on a few different sites, but mostly on one called airgigs.com. So there's two things. There's one recently, someone who completely he wrote a prompt and got a bunch of songs and he sent me them and asked me if I wanted to record them. Basically, it's just AI slop. And I don't know why he's not happy with the AI. Well, I do know why he's not happy with the AI version. But anyway, so there's that. And plus, I'm getting a lot of session stuff, demos that are made by AI now, and they have really, really crazily unrealistic expectations, especially vocally, of what's possible, because AI can do stuff that human beings can't. And I think most people don't realize what the male voice can do, or the female voice, or any instrument, really. It's a mess, man. Never mind the copyright aspects of AI, how they've basically gone through and trolled the internet for every piece of music ever recorded and just basically stolen it, and including the person's voice and kind of approach to making music. So, yeah, I'm really not a big fan of AI. I think as a tool for something like helping people find cancer or something, it'd be brilliant, as long as it didn't get it wrong as much as ChatGPT does. And if it's making our breakfast, great. But as far as making art is concerned, I think art is something that involves the human experience, and AI just can't do that. So it can't tap into that kind of feeling, that kind of chicken skin, goosebumps thing that good music gives us. I don't think it'll ever do that because it can't experience it.
I was looking at the country music. There's one that's number one that's recently was AI generated, Walk My Walk. Have you heard that at all? Because that's sort of gone to number one, and that's quite scary that...
I heard about it, but I didn't listen to it. I try and avoid it as much as I can. I don't want to feed the machine, really. So I don't use it, and I avoid watching or listening to any of that stuff.
It didn't tell you it was AI-generated. The only reason I did it, because I knew it was. So that's what I thought. Oh, that you weren't even made aware.
Yeah, I think labelling is the least they can do. I've yet to be fooled by AI. I can usually hear it. But it is getting better, you know, technically. But I think most people, when they see it, they know when it's fake, mostly. There's always a giveaway somewhere. And it's the same with the music, if you know what you're listening for. Little artifacts like extra fingers, you know? extra fingers in the music. You know?
Yeah,
so it's the same in the music. I'm a proud Luddite, really. I mean, Luddites have a bad connotation these days, but all they were really doing back in the day, they weren't anti-technology. They were just anti-rich people using it to exploit poor people even more and ruin their lives. So, and that's what AI is about, really. It's about money. You know, I think it's a tool that could be useful in some kind of things, but it's also really dangerous, and I hope it falls over.
Just a crazy little thing called love. Just a crazy little thing called love. Just a crazy.
What other musical projects have you got on your activities at the moment there, Darren?
Yeah, so I'm obviously doing all the sessions and stuff, which is good, and I also teach guitar and always looking for more students. So if anyone out there wants to learn how to play and sing, you know, get in touch. Easy enough to find online, just darrenwatson.com, and all my contact details are there. And so I've always got the constant teaching thing, and I love doing it because there's just so much to learn from teaching, as well as obviously, it's nice to kind of make a living. So session work and teaching. Last year, I produced an album for my friend Matt Hay, which did really well and got the Best Americana album at their local Folk Awards in Dunedin, which was really cool. I've done some producing for a woman from Taranaki called Karen Clark, and a couple of singles for her, and we're talking about an album in 26. And I've got a bunch of songs of mine that I need to get kind of under control in some way. So I'm hoping in the next couple of years I can get something along those lines happening. So always something on the go. And I've been offered a couple of other projects that I need to find out if I've got time for, really. Yeah, and obviously just playing and practicing and writing and kind of maintaining a life.
I thought we'd go out with Ride Along. What was your sort of interpretation and thoughts when you were recording that song?
Well, I just thought, I mean, I love that slow turning record, but it's very Nashville, and I wanted to kind of turn it on its ear and make it more of a Memphis kind of vibe, which, if people aren't aware, Nashville's very much the center of country music in the States, and Memphis, which isn't that far away, they're both in the same state, Tennessee, is more of a melting pot city. It's where rock and roll came from, and rockabilly, and a lot of early blues was recorded there, and so I kind of wanted to go for that kind of, put it in a room with like early Elvis tunes, you know, 1954 kind of Elvis, 55, before he was super famous, where he's just a regional star. But it was basically just a guitar, a double bass, and an electric guitar. That was his band. And so I wanted to put it in that kind of context. Yeah, I think it works really well. It's kind of got a nice jumpy kind of rockabilly vibe, and I'm really thrilled with the performance that came on the day.
Well, you get up in the morning, you get on the bus, don't want to think about nothing, don't want to raise no fuss. You come home in the evening, turn the TV on, but you ain't going nowhere. The Sunday paper on Saturday night, you read the travel section,
until you're all uptight. 'Cause it's almost Monday. Check, you know that song. 'Cause you ain't going nowhere. Heard of the guy they mention. Sometimes that girl may sneak you a kiss, but she's just another song nebulous. And you're tired of sleepwalking. The cat's out, but she ain't talking.
John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Ride Along from the Darren Watson Sings John Hiatt album. Darren's Hut launch gigs may be sold out, but his album is available as a CD or as a download from the usual platforms. Check out his website for details, darrenwatson.com. This Sunday is Hutt Valley Orchestra's festival concert, 3 p.m. at St. James's Church Lower Hutt. A variety program, Brahms, Bach, a new work by Nicola Kirkup, and a bit of carol singing. But sadly, that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hutt Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a Hutt story or a piece of music or poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with some music from Upper Hutt's Yahoo, also known as Choir Boy. Here's one of his classic tracks, Someone Stole My Jandals. Mate wa e noho oru mai ra. Stay well.
This is based on a true story. I was living in Nainai. Somebody stole my jandals. I left them on my back porch. Somebody stole my brand new jandals. Man, I felt like a dog. I never leave my jandals on the porch again. Why did I leave my jandals on the porch again? Somebody stole my hoodie. I hung it on my washing line. Somebody stole my brand new hoodie. It cost me $9.95. I never had my hoodie on the line again. What's it? I leave my hoodie on the line again. Somebody stole my missus. I left her on my back porch. Somebody stole my brand new old missus. Man, I felt like a dope. But she was from Wanui. She was from Wanui. She was from Wanui. But it's okay because I got an upgrade.
Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, I got an upgrade.
Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, I got an upgrade. My gentles, I left them on my back porch. Somebody stole my brand new pair of gentles. Man, I felt like a joke. I never leave my gentles on the porch again. What's it? I leave my gentles on the porch again. Stole my hoodie, I hung it on my washing line. Somebody stole my brand new hoodie. It cost me $9.95. I never had my hoodie on the line again. What's it? I leave my hoodie on the line again. Stole my missus, I left her on my back porch. Somebody stole my brand new old missus. Man, I felt like a joke. But it's okay because she was from Wanui. She was from Wanui. She was from Wanui.
That explains.
But it's okay because kids have got an upgrade.
Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, got an upgrade.
Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, got an upgrade. 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 Yeah, got an upgrade.
I got me an upgrade.
Yeah, got an upgrade.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.